Open House on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. It's here at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us for the open house and an evening of on-air programming hosted by Barbara Bernstein and featuring Carol Major, Victoria Stafiello, and Maureen Key. We're celebrating the contribution of women volunteers, DJs, on-air hosts, staff, and board members in making KABU what it is today. Light snacks and drinks will be provided. Everyone is welcome. Again, that's the Women of KABU celebration and open house. It's on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Southeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
Love and life interested me so that I dared to knock at the door that was closed.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th at 6:30 p.m. at EcoTrust in Portland. The Portland Solstice Celebration is a benefit party and open house in support of Rogue Farm Corps and their work training new farmers and preserving farmland. The event features live music, food and drinks, a raffle, and more. Again, that's the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m., at which time I am pleased, privileged, honored, as well as contractually obligated to inform you that KBOO programming is made possible by KABU listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. And with that, it's time for Pacific Underground. Woo!
Good morning, Portland. You are listening to Pacific Underground, and I am joined by Jake. How are you doing, Jake?
Good morning.
Today.
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
Okay, good, good. So today we have Jackie Loomis Peterson with us.
Peterson Loomis.
Oh, sorry, Peterson Loomis. Of Portland Chinatown Museum.
Historical museum? Or is it just museum?
Well, it is called the Portland Chinatown Museum.
Oh,
and
okay.
And there's a reason for that, so we can talk about that. But we are a part of the Portland Chinatown History Foundation, which is a 501c3 organization founded in and registered in Oregon, and we date back to we actually got the formal IRS approval as a nonprofit in 2014, but we started in 2013.
Oh, has the museum been around for a while?
Well, no. I mean, the group has been around for quite a while, actually. And if you want me to start in on this, I can.
Sure. I just heard about the museum a few weeks ago. And
you've been hiding.
And I thought it was so cool and so great that there was finally a museum to preserve this, who knows, this history, because who knows how much longer Chinatown is going to be there.
Well, and it's not just how long Chinatown is going to be. That is part of our mission. I mean, we're very much concerned with stabilizing and preserving, maybe even in some fashion reactivating what was called New Chinatown, and I'll get into that in a minute, because there was an older and much bigger Chinatown. This was the second largest Chinatown in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Before 1900, and it stretched from Burnside down to Mill along 2nd Avenue.
Wow.
It was a large merchant community.
Oh, wow.
And it was succeeded by what's called New Chinatown after, in the decade between 1900 and 1910, when several forces came together to really devastate this Chinese merchant community, which had been building something quite extraordinary. It would be very difficult to call it a ghetto. I mean, it was huge, and it was vibrant, and people were going from, you know, arriving as immigrants without terrific means, but having the ability and the desire to, you know, to sort of make it, and many did. I mean, there were several millionaires in that community.
Wow.
In any event, I mean, they were very much connected to the white elite in the city, and we can go into that at another time. But what happened between 1900 and 1910 were two things that were just should never have happened together, but they did. One of them was the decision on the part of the federal government to make the Chinese Exclusion Act permanent. Mm-hmm. It had been passed in 82 and was renewed in 92. In 1902, they said, yes, let's renew it again. In 1904, they said, let's just forget this. Let's just not allow anybody to come in.
Wow.
And
yeah.
So that was, I mean, it had already been highly restrictive. I mean, you had to be a member of the merchant class, or you had to be a diplomat or a student to gain entry. But after 1904, effectively, the gates closed.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the beginning of a phenomenon that very few people know about, but the group that I'm working with, because they lived it, you know, are beginning, like, it's beginning discussed nationally, too, and this is this whole phenomenon of paper sons and daughters.
Oh,
when between 1900, right, roughly, you know, and in the 1940s, that these are people who the only way they can get in is to take a false identity.
Right,
and this
right.
became quite a business, and we have no idea, but it's tens of thousands of people who came to Canada and the United States during this period. And it was something that was hidden, or at least not talked about, at least from the point of view of the Caucasian community. They didn't understand this or know anything about it.
Yeah.
But it's a feature of this extraordinarily long period in which the Chinese, unlike the Japanese and other Asians, who were finally roped into this exclusion piece after the 20s, but the Chinese had been influenced by this set of laws which really made it very, very difficult not only for workers to come, but for women to come, women and children. And so this created a tremendous demographic sort of imbalance, gender imbalance on the part of the Chinese.
Society.
Yes, and that was a kind of, it was also an ephemeral one, because it was really only apparent during periods which were fallow. I mean, mostly bachelor workers were out in the field. They were either working for railroads or canneries or, you know, in public works, a lot of that. But in the off seasons, they came into town, and the merchant community basically supported them.
Oh,
but that was a whole different thing. I mean, yes, they couldn't bring their wives and families, and if they went back, they couldn't get back in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we ended up with a lot of people, I mean, who just became old and finally died here. A lot of merchants, I mean, in fact, these are stories I don't think are apocryphal from old families that I know, who say that their grandparents basically paid to send these workers home.
Oh, wow.
You know, so many people did get to go home, but others, you know, were here. But even during the period when, you know, this was a robust community, I mean, there were so few women, at least across the scale of workers to middle class merchants, that it was skewed heavily, and that was something that took, I mean, another 30 years, really, until the 1950s and 60s before the gender imbalance began to right itself.
Right.
So that's a very long
Immigration Act of 1965 that allowed for a lot more Asian.
Well,
countries.
It did, because before that, I mean, exclusion effectively ended, legally ended in 43, because the government finally said, what are we going to do about these people who are now our allies?
Right.
we better admit a few. And that's all they did. They admitted 100 a year, which was not enough. And then there was the War Brides Act, which helped a little bit, but it really is 65
when
you begin to see large numbers of Asians and Chinese immigrants coming.
Yeah, and my own Filipino grandfather was one of those people who was like fighting in World War II for the Americans and was promised citizenship, but unfortunately, because of bureaucratic, you know, structural racism, it took many, many years before he was able to emigrate.
I mean, there are really significant issues of needs for redress in the Chinese community that just, you know, are still waiting there, and they haven't been well publicized. I think that's true in the Filipino community too. And I think it's time because in Oregon, I mean, it's interesting that the state educational standards, which are there to probably help teachers figure out what they're supposed to teach at certain grade levels. Mm-hmm. And in the last few years, I mean, there has been some real progress made in terms of curriculum units or portions of units that address diversity most recently. Oh. But before that, I mean, certainly the Nikkei, African Americans, Native Americans, there is not a word about Chinese Americans or exclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's simply an unknown story.
About what you were saying about the exclusion's effect on this thriving Chinatown community, I wanted to place that in a little larger context of sort of like Jim Crow sort of racial violence and pogroms. And I mean, you were seeing a lot of things happen across the country, but West Coast, especially with Asian immigrants.
That's really true. And so what happened, I mean, there were roughly, I mean, the Chinese were about a tenth of the population of Portland in 1890. Pretty big.
Wow.
Significant. Yeah.
It is very significant. It's very significant.
Much less now.
But something else happened in 1904-05. This was Portland's opportunity for future greatness. This was the Lewis and Clark, people don't know the whole name. This is the Lewis and Clark Centennial Exposition and Oriental Fair.
Now, the Chinese didn't participate.
No, that's right. The Chinese didn't participate, but the Japanese did. The imperial government was part of that fair, which was a world's fair.
And Filipinos participated.
Did they
but
also?
Kind of they were forced to because they were an American colony at the time.
Right, exactly.
And,
the Chinese refused to participate, but they came to the fair. That's what's so interesting. I mean, this merchant community, we've seen a very few pictures of these merchant families at the fair. So
they were joining the sort of crowds of gawkers and whatnot.
Yeah, and it was that period, of course, of anthropology, which was, you know, unbelievable.
Very exoticized.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it was really pretty terrible. But what that meant was that it attracted all of these visitors from the East and the Midwest, and the result was a boom unlike anything Portland has seen since, including the current day. Within 25 years, the population doubled and then tripled. And it was like a tsunami, you know, that just washed over. Remember that the old Chinatown is along Second Avenue, you know. Mm-hmm. So there are businesses and missions and tongs that are sort of also spread toward the water as well as all the way to 4th and 5th. And suddenly you've got all this new money, this new capital coming in, and very few of the Chinese merchants actually owned their own property. Some did, and that was illegal, but some already did, and they stayed. Some did stay.
Right.
But
weren't they prevented because of sort of like racial laws?
That, yeah, I mean, they weren't allowed to own property. They weren't allowed to be citizens. They weren't allowed to marry outside of their race.
Or testify in court.
Right, all of that. I mean, but they found ways to get around that. I mean, the Chinese were very, very sophisticated in their ability to work the system. They were.
And we still are.
And still are. That's right. That's correct. And that was true all through the early 19th century, 20th century as well. So anyway, it meant that suddenly this community is just being priced out. And so many people went back to China if they had made a fortune. Some people went to San Francisco and Seattle, which earlier their population had sort of emptied out and come here potentially. Because Portland had a reputation, deserved or not, that it was less violent. You know, friendly to the Chinese merchant community. And that was true in some ways and not true in others. But after 1905, there was just this sort of exodus. And so this population that was a tenth of the population and probably as many as 10 to 11, 12,000 is reduced to 3,000, you know, within 25 years. And so most of those who stayed moved north of Burnside, which had always been... it's very like the Lower East Side in New York. I mean, it was the vice district. I mean, it was the point of entry for immigrants, and particularly for immigrant male
workers.
The
gambling dens.
Yes. But, I mean, that had always been there. Red Light District. In fact, it was called Whitechapel after this is Jack the Ripper story kind of stuff, you know, from London.
Whitechapel, London.
So it was quite a neighborhood, and that's where African-Americans and Nikkei also settled there.
A Japanese and African American community near Union Station.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly where the Chinese now are moving. Now they had already there were always Chinese laundries north of Burnside and so-called, I mean, we're not sure exactly what they were, but there was evidence of prostitution north of Burnside. But the merchant community, by and large, was south of Burnside. Mm-hmm. But so now you see the people who stayed.
They were getting displaced,
and they started a development project of which only. One building remains, and it isn't even an original building. And that was a 2.5-block-long development project from Davis to Flanders along 4th Avenue, where the Sui Sing is now the Movil. Their business is there. That was the only one. That's of the 7 or 8 Tongs and family associations in the neighborhood. For all of the talk about people leaving, the Sui Sing is the only one that has actually sold the building and left. Wow. The others are still there. And so now this is a very, very important moment, I think. It really is. I mean, they've held off until now, but the pressures are even greater after the most, as the most recent, city council vote would suggest. And so so we're, you know, we're in that fight, surely, because I think, you know, I was fortunate enough to get here early enough. It was the last kind of the last moment when one could sort of see the remains of what was truly a vibrant new Chinatown. And that was in the mid-90s when I came here from Moscow, Idaho, and started history as a field at the new WSU campus in Vancouver.
This is
an aside, but my field was then Native American Studies, although I was in a department at both the University of Minnesota and at WSU, which was like a comparative American cultures department that included Asian American, African American, Chicano history and Native American history. I mean, I was always in one of those departments. But I had done a really major exhibition that kicked me out of the classroom for a long time at WSU called Sacred Encounters, which was about missionaries and Native peoples in Montana and Idaho. Because I had fallen into this discovery of unknown drawings and maps that led to a huge traveling show. So I'd already done one really big exhibit, and that was why I moved, because it had used a lot of AV, a lot of film, as well as a lot of oral histories with contemporary tribal elders. And it was all produced in Portland. And it was fabricated here, and I kind of had the bug, you know, now. I wanted to do public history, and so I moved here. They let me move here. Everybody said, why would you want to move from Pullman and leave your graduate students? And I said, they visit me in Portland, and they get it, you know, but I didn't move to Vancouver.
So you moved to Portland before it was cool.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, I have to say that when I was living, I mean, I'm a Midwesterner, and when I was living in Moscow, when I would drive to California through Portland, it was always pouring. You know, and I thought, what the horrible place this must be to live. You know, but I got very enamored of it, because I really got to know people in the film community when I was working on this big exhibit, and I just fell in love with the city. And I just, in fact, when I moved here, I mean, two things happened. One, even though I was teaching in Vancouver, I really established and still maintain a social life that's here in Portland that is much more diverse in terms of the arts. And secondly, I found Old Town Chinatown. I mean, that happened very fast for me. I mean, my exhibit, the Sacred Encounters exhibit, went to 7 cities, and it traveled between 93 and 97. And it was at OHS. That was one of the last two venues. And then also the brand new then museum, History Museum in Washington, which is in Tacoma. Okay. And then the Coeur d'Alene tribe bought the furniture. This story is important because it's like a prelude. The Coeur d'Alene tribe wanted it. They wanted to bring it home. So this took a while. It took almost 12 years. But finally...
They want to bring the artifacts in the
story,
exhibit?
Because the exhibit, I mean, this is a different kind of history making. This was a story. It was a tale. It was multimedia. It was very emotional. It was driven by the voices of the people. I mean, we decided very early on, even though it's kind of like a sort of call and response, it's got two worlds here. We've got European, you know, kind of Catholicism with all of its gold and silver, and then we've got this natural world where, you know, everyone is sort of basically equal. And so it's not artifact driven. It's really voices driven and music and other things. And so, particularly on the Native side. And so
you could afford to lose the artifacts and still maintain the integrity.
Right, exactly. Although we found an extraordinary, it was one of these things that's happening again with the Chinese community. We found this extraordinary community of artifacts in Europe that had been taken from these communities back to Europe. And we were able to find them and bring some of them home. That was really great. And it's that kind of discovery process that was very much at the heart of that project that is part of this one too. I mean, it's like it's working finally again with a group of elders, and it's finding helping them find their history and find the artifacts, and it's doing oral histories. It's the sort of the same thing. And so what happened with, you don't even know this, I guess, that the exhibit, the big exhibit that we're going to be installing in the new museum is called...
The new Chinatown Museum.
Yes, it's called Beyond the Gate, A Tale of Portland's Historic Chinatowns.
Mm. Oh, wow.
This exhibit, which was 25, almost 3,000 square feet, was at the Oregon Historical Society 2 years ago as a partner to the show that came from New York called Chinese American Exclusion Inclusion. Oh. And I was asked basically to develop this partner show, but I was also the person that suggested to OHS that they bring the show from New York.
Yeah.
Because I'm friends with Jack Chen, and they were, you know, MoCA was part of that that exhibit. And I just thought, having by then already been very involved in the Asian American community in Old Town, working with both the Nikkei and the Chinese American community, that, and I know about the Filipino community, by the way, that had, they had a place there too. That was partly their community in the 30s and 40s.
In Portland?
Yes, in Old Town.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, canneries worker, Filipino
like
canneries
worker.
Like
a mini Manila town.
Yeah, huh. Yeah, like yeah. There were restaurants, the Filipino cannery unions workers had their headquarters there. And we're still interested in sort of making a connection there. But anyway, so...
And if you're just tuning in, folks, we're you're here with Pacific Underground
with
and Jake and Tabitha talking with Jackie Peterson-Loomis about the new Chinatown Museum that just opened up. And
so back to your early question about whether this is an art or a history museum, it is both. But what you've seen so far is just part of our art intent, which is to say that we want to give... We don't want to devote the gallery exclusively to this purpose, but I would say 75% it'll be a venue for young Asian American artists in all media. So that's performance, it's theater, it's music, it's visual arts, it's the spoken word. So the next show will be curated by Horatio Law. It'll be a group show.
Yeah.
I think Roberta Wong will have something in that, maybe Valerie Otani. So, but we're going to bring King of the Yees for two weekends, which is this wonderful play by Laura Nee that was performed in Seattle. She's an amazing playwright from San Francisco. Young in her 30s, she's written 4 or 5 plays, and two of them were performed in Seattle last fall.
Oh, wow.
That's brilliant.
I mean, it's amazing. And so, yeah, so we're going to be doing that, which and we're going to be working closely now, I think, with media rights as well, so that we're
going
to be providing a stage, so we'll be able to do readings. Joe Kai performed for the opening, but we want to have other performers, whether they're spoken word, you know, whether they're musicians, whether they're dancers. We have the space to do this in this gallery.
I'm going to get in touch with you about.
I mean, it's 1,000 square foot. Absolutely. I mean, it's 1,000 square feet. It's a beautiful gallery. I mean, you'll have to come in right now. It's gorgeous because we just got our admissions desk finished, and includes. The front is like these marble tiles with peonies. Mm. I mean, it is, I shouldn't even talk about it. It's very exquisite.
Tabitha and I were planning to come after the opening event, but
well, you'll have
we
to
found
come
out
on,
that it was closed
because
for...
Dean Wong will be back on the first Thursday in July.
Oh, okay.
And so we'll have more books because he has a wonderful book. He's quite well known. It's called Seeing the Light.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 4 decades in Chinatown. It's got great review in the New York Times. This was last year. And these are his longtime... He'll talk about himself, but I mean, he's cataloged the kind of inside with great feeling and depth of both Seattle and San Francisco's Chinatowns. So he's selling that book, and we're going to be putting together this little booklet to sell, which is all of the photographs and all of the text that he's written for this show that he's created just for our museum as a kind of way to help getting us our
Jackie's
started
referring
out.
To. Pamphlet that Tabitha and I got a sneak preview of that has these full color photographs of Dean
life
Wong
in,
and life in
yeah,
Chinatown
that
and,
he took
and, as well as some personal narrative
which is just fascinating to read. And I think it's that this the Chinatown Museum having this also a gallery space, a multimedia gallery space is really great. Did you work with the property owner to develop and renovate this space?
Well, what we're hoping to do, the property owner, Lewis Lee, owns a quarter block there, and I've known him for many years. And that was actually where the museum has been developed is inside what was called the Keita building. And it was a very large space. It hadn't really been used in recent years, but it was the workspace for the Classical Chinese Garden when it opened, and also for Northwest China Council for a while. But it's been empty for a while.
Oh, for the Lansu Chinese Garden?
Yes, when it first started, before it was built.
So it was like a pilot project?
Well, their staff was in there, where they were raising money, and then it was staff from the Northwest China Council. But then it lay empty, and I think Lewis and his sister, who's a co-owner, Christina, and what I want to say about them is it's really quite extraordinary, because in all of the time that New Chinatown was sort of confronting, you know, issues of lack of support from the city and whatever, there was only there were only two merchants that built new businesses and buildings. One of them was the Tuck Lung, which had been a grocery store in Chinatown on 4th, and they built the Tuck Lung. And then Louis Lee came from Hong Kong in the early 90s, and he's a CPA, and he bought that building, you know, with the hope that he was going to be able to sort of provide some stability for other kinds of Chinese businesses. And I don't think that ever fully developed, although, you know, he was, but we got to know him quite well, and he was very supportive of this crazy idea that this group of elders, I mean, most of our board are in their 80s and 90s.
Oh, wow.
You know, and, and so these are people who grew up in Chinatown or had businesses there. They feel very deeply about it. We've interviewed all of them. I mean, taken their life stories. And I mean, they're really treasures. And but it's a larger community. I mean, there's a new movement in the last decade or so whereby all of the people who have some kind of connection to Chinatown meet twice a year for lunch at the... And it's one of the buffets on 82nd, on the south of Holgate. I'm trying to think what it's called. But anyway, we all go there, and it's like more than 225 people come to this.
Oh, wow.
I mean, these are, and it gets bigger. I mean, these are people who really do care about that community, even though, you know, they've moved out, and many of them moved out in the 50s, 40s and 50s, when they were granted citizenship. It was still hard to buy property. Even so, but nonetheless, there was, you know, there were places like Ladd's Addition that had always been more friendly to Asians and Italians.
A large Asian community.
Yeah,
Ladd's
but
Addition.
Italians too.
So. So what do you think the recent Portland City Council vote to increase the building height in Old Town Chinatown, how do you think that's going to change the dynamic of the neighborhood?
Well, as I've been down there now since the mid to late 90s. I mean, I think I started working there close to full time as an, and I've been, you know, I've been just sort of a, I don't know what you would call it. I'm a volunteer, a full-time volunteer. I've been a full-time volunteer for about 20 years. And, and, you know, just seeing this as, you know, such an incredibly important place. This one place in lily white Portland that has always been multi-ethnic, you know, I mean, it's the place where people begin their lives, and from there they go and they succeed. And that's been largely true of every group that's come through the city, with the caveat that, of course, people of color, even by moving out, didn't necessarily mean that they achieved inclusion or equality. But but it, that process, though, of trying to become American or hyphenated American has been sort of, it's been through the whole history of Portland, but really pretty much tucked into that part of Portland. And it also has, and it's two historic districts. It has this Skidmore Old Town District, which is a way to preserve what very little is left of this beautiful cast iron architecture. And then just to the west, actually it's an overlap. Three half blocks of the New Chinatown Japantown Historic District do overlap with Skidmore. In fact, our building is one of them. You know, so our heights are 75 feet. But the district was created by the city at Portland Development Commission's instigation in the late 80s. Now, this was in part a response, you know, to desires by the community to do something. And I think that the idea was that this was going to stimulate redevelopment. But unfortunately, I think it is fair to say that the Chinese business owners never really understood what the advantages were mm-hmm. of being in an historic district, whereas those property owners yeah. who were not Asian immediately began to take these tax credits. And, I mean, they're sitting on a potentially very valuable property, mm-hmm. even though it's a skid row from the point of
it's
view
so
of many
central.
People.
Yeah.
It's so central. Yeah. It's so close to the water. It's so, mm-hmm. and that's the vulnerability, of course. So
right.
when I got there, it was very
Vultures.
Clear. It was very mm-hmm. clear that everyone in the Pearl was looking, you mm-hmm. know, rarely.
Circling around.
They were circling the wagons. And that's why I think I referred to this. Somebody did tell me that I was the person with the thumb in the dike. And if mm-hmm. I hadn't come back, you know, that they would have taken the district.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
wow.
And so I think everybody, that's the intention, and we all realize now that there's wins and loses here. There's both benefits and not for mm-hmm. for Chinese property owners, because clearly, I mean, if they sell out to a developer, they'll make far less than they would yeah. if they held on to their property. But at
yeah.
the same time, you know, they have something, and they have quite a bit,
right.
perhaps this
yeah.
this day, and you know, you can take this to 82nd and perhaps do something else.
Right.
So that's
money
really,
now versus
this
money
is,
later.
This is that's right. I think finally. They've been trying for about 15 years, from my observation, to persuade these owners to sell,
mm-hmm.
and only one so far has. But
oh, good.
But
That's
I
good.
Think but I yeah but I think that now, because the stakes are higher and property values are rising, you know, that the temptation is very great, and
mm-hmm.
so.
And
I just
do you
don't.
Think, how do you think that that major post office redevelopment is going to affect? The character of the neighborhood.
I actually think, from what I know about it, that the post office development is an opportunity on land that is not really dispossessing
right.
a large number of people, is a place to begin to develop something that does solve in part the need for housing that is, you know, mixed
affordable.
Housing. You
mm-hmm.
know, what we our problem is that all we have in Old Town is affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have SROs.
Right.
You know, and so we could use some workforce housing as what this is what Innovative Housing has been doing. They have bought some historic buildings in the last 10 years and turned them into apartments, like the Erickson Building, which also has a nice gallery. I mean, there's an
oh.
effort in this neighborhood,
yeah.
you know, on the part of the Nikkei. Now the new Jewish Museum is back again in the neighborhood. They're four
oh.
or five blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in Northwest for a while, and they're back in the neighborhood.
Oh.
And so we want to see the African-American community develop a mm-hmm. museum there. We have three universities. We have
oh.
OCOM. We
oh.
have PNCA. And we
mm-hmm.
have the U of O.
Oh,
and suddenly
wow.
there's a need for student housing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh, I didn't
so
know the U of O's camp.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and
there's
and
a
it's
satellite
growing,
camp.
And
house.
It's growing.
Yeah.
It's growing. And so, you know, even though the city has been saying for the last decade, and it's, from my point of view, it's not a very... It's only a holding pattern, because it isn't a way to sustain a community. Their strategy has been this entertainment district
mm-hmm.
model, which is really only
there
at
are so
night.
Many bars and clubs,
and they're not open during the day.
Yeah.
Right.
So you don't have a vibrant daytime activity.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually build community.
No. So,
yeah.
so it's like they're just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So here we are, and I think now the question, the dilemma for most of us now, is will we appeal this recent vote? Because we basically they were holding the line.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been constant, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there were two votes before this. This has been a 3.5-year process, beginning with, we were all there at the West Quadrant meetings back, that was 2016, every month testifying in favor of the lower heights for New
mm-hmm.
Chinatown,
mm-hmm.
Japantown, and Skidmore. And then that went into these prolonged kind of more public meetings and city council meetings. And there were two that led up to this last one, in which there was, you know, intense lobbying on both sides, some of it behind
mm-hmm.
the scenes. But it was always a close vote, and we had maintained it. But then what happened at the last minute was this is unfortunately a situation where there's been a total lack of process, because
mm-hmm.
even though this is what can happen, and you know this happens in many places.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Portland. We are talking with the executive director of the Portland Chinatown Museum, and Jackie Peterson Loomis. And later on, we'll be talking to photographer Dean Wong, who currently has an exhibit at the Portland Chinatown Museum. This actually might be a good segue to see if he is on the line.
Yes, he is. I must have got music for a break.
Okay, I do want to make sure that we talk about the beyond. Oh, damn it. I think I turned this off.
Dean, good morning. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. It is a pleasure to speak to you.
You got Tabitha Teo and Jake Vermas here with you, and Jackie.
How did you get in contact with the folks of the Portland of what remains of Portland Chinatown to photograph and document their stories?
Well, my friend Ron Chu, who has been advising them on funding, told me about the museum and the project, and I was very intrigued, and I wanted to help out. So I came down and saw the Beyond the Gate show and visited with Jackie at the Golden Horse, and I offered to do this project.
Awesome. Jackie provided us with a digital copy of the booklet that will be sold at the museum, and I was really interested in your personal narrative and a story of your relationship to Portland Chinatown. And what were your best memories about the Portland Chinatown back in the day?
I don't actually remember Chinatown that much. I just remember the train ride with my mom and visiting our relatives at their bean sprout factory. But like I said in my intro, I'm sure like any Chinese relatives getting together, we must have had dinner in Chinatown.
And
it could have been at one of the restaurants that is no longer exists.
Yeah, which is so unfortunate. I didn't even until
you
I
have a connection with Chinatown growing up, right, Tabitha?
I do.
Even though you didn't live in Portland?
Yes, I'm from Salem, Oregon, but my family did come up, I would say, once, maybe twice a month to Portland, and we'd shop in Chinatown at the grocery store, and then we would sometimes go to dim sum at the House of Louis restaurant, and yeah, and it's been really depressing for me to see over like a 10-20 year decline of Chinatown. And but one thing I am glad that is back there was I really liked your photograph, Dean, of the Hung Far Low restaurant sign. Because I'm sure everyone has giggled over the name of it, and I certainly laughed at the name of it. And but yeah, then one day I noticed I was in the neighborhood, and I noticed, oh no, it's gone, it's closed, it's gone, and it's back. So I think it's a really great piece of Portland history that's back at the old corner. And I liked your anecdote about how hard it was to get a good angle of it. What else is around the building that made it like a difficult shot to get?
From the ground level, it's hard to get an interesting photograph of the sign. So I actually was not going to include any photograph of the sign in the show until I went up to the Jihao Oaktin Association, and there through the window up from the second floor was the Hung Far Low sign in late afternoon light with long shadows, and I loved the photo.
Is that photo included in your exhibit?
Yes.
Awesome.
Might become a poster.
I would love it if it was a poster.
We're thinking of that.
Yeah, it's very iconic. You know, in light of just the symbol of it returning to downtown Chinatown, as well as the existence of the museum as a symbol, as well as like, you know, places like, you know, the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle, where you're from, and, you know, the International Hotel in San Francisco, I was wondering if, you know, both you and Jackie could talk a little bit about, the importance of symbols in terms of like building community and just sort of reclaiming the narrative rather than just, you know, physical space. So that, because, Yeah, not just the photographs that you had, but I thought it was also the narratives that, you know, were with, you know, each business owner, like Golden Horse and, you know, all these other places. So I was wondering if you guys could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'll just talk
about the people I spoke to all seem still proud of Chinatown and what is left. You know, there's not much left, but it's still Chinatown. There's
right.
still restaurants. There are still associations that hold meetings in their buildings. It's not what it used to be, but mm-hmm. there still is a spirit there, although it's hard to see when you walk down the street.
Mm-hmm. For me, it's the loss of For me, having arrived there in the mid '90s, when I would say there were probably six or seven restaurants that were very active, as well as I was mentioning two Japanese restaurants as well, that there were places where there were large numbers of people who congregated at lunchtime in particular, and the people who were older would come down at night, and most of these family associations have either second floors or basements, you know, where people can get together and play mahjong and other kinds of games, and you know, and just, you know, get together and talk, and that was really a really big part of that social life. And I failed to mention this earlier, but one of the really critical things that happened is that between 2000 and 2000, I think 2008 or 2009, in an effort to, quote, revitalize Chinatown, the Portland Development Commission and the city embarked on this process of beautification. Some might call it, you know, an effort at the beginnings of gentrification, but it meant that the streets around Chinatown were closed down twice for a year at a time, making parking extremely difficult, and it completely disrupted mm-hmm. the business cycle. And so restaurants that were doing extremely well, you know, suddenly are losing customers not only during the day but in the evenings.
Yeah.
And the worst part of that then became the parking meters, you know, which were only like, you know, 2-hour parking meters.
Mm-hmm.
And so this again really disrupted, you know, what had been a very long, I mean, I have to say that Chinatown, it's not as though it looks tremendously different than it did, you know, 20 years ago. It's just that the people are gone.
It's just,
you know,
the shell.
The people are gone. I mean, the places are still there. The Tongs are still there. The family associations are there. Their members still come. The thing I love that we don't want to lose at any cost is the Yat Sing Music Club that performs in the basement.
Which I thought was so cool. And I didn't know about this until I read saw the photograph and read about it. And the thing that really inspired me was I really want to figure out how I could get involved. And so I was Googling a bunch of the associations and the Chinese Benevolent Association.
Yeah, right.
And it was really fascinating. Dean, for the book that you published, you traveled to a bunch of different Chinatowns. What are maybe similarities that you've seen between all the different Chinatowns you've visited?
Similarities? They're all going through development and gentrification.
Mm.
In Seattle, we have a lot of new apartment buildings going up, and it's totally changing. It's starting to change the character of our Chinatown. We have a historic hotel called the Milwaukee Hotel, and that was redeveloped. So most of the residents there are non-Asian, and all the storefront businesses on the ground level have replaced traditional Chinese stores. So that whole block is gentrified.
Oh, wow.
And there's a new development across the street. There was a building that partially burnt down. Now it's being redeveloped. So those storefronts will open too. So we'll see who occupy those spaces.
Yeah.
Hope they're Chinese.
How do you feel about the Seattle Chinatown being called the International District?
I call it Chinatown. and there are people that there are people that call it the International District because traditionally it's been more than Chinese living in that area, just like Portland's Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
But I make a conscious choice just to call it Chinatown, and I don't argue with anybody about what to call it. I just call it what I would call it.
I find some similarities in the renaming of the Seattle Chinatown to the International District, and how a lot of the longtime residents of Portland's Chinatown and the 82nd New Chinatown, but they were saying, no, this is the original Chinatown. And I also appreciate how everyone was just so determined to stay. And Jackie, you mentioned this, that the people and the associations that are there were, no, we're here. We're going to fight all the gentrification, all the developers.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the financial incentives, unfortunately, are growing. There's no question that if this sticks, if the 200 feet sticks, I think there will be more than one appeal even, but mm-hmm. If it's unsuccessful, then I think that this really raises the stakes tremendously. Unfortunately, the four blocks that are north of Everett, which is the northern half of the historic district, the garden is not within it, but it's across the street from the garden.
Oh,
and so we've got those issues, but then there's also One Tong is north of Everett. This is the Hop Sing, which is where you probably went there. It used to be the old Fong Chong, which also was a grocery store, and they sold dim sum. That was always my favorite place to go for dim sum, and I really miss it.
I know you said tongs a few times. Can you please explain what a tong is?
Well, probably Dean could do a better job of that than I could.
Dean, could you please explain what it is?
It's a Chinese organization created out of survival, I guess. You know,
okay.
People coming together to help each other and form groups to, you know, help newcomers get settled and give people places to hang out
and live too, right?
Okay.
I mean, the ones that are, I mean, they're both family associated. I mean, what I was told was that the Tongs are kind of an extension of the family associations, and the people who belong to Tongs bring with them family names that are not large enough in the community to sustain their own family association, so that they band together.
Okay.
But historically, those that were able to acquire a building after 43. I mean, most of them couldn't even. They moved into this neighborhood and bought these buildings after the war. Mm. But the third floors were the places where they would rent to incoming immigrants, and that's still true. At least one of them. And Dean did in fact interview and photographed at least the room of one of the people. It's a very poignant story too.
Oh, the only seven Chinese
residents. Yeah, right. What I was trying to say before is that this has been true of this Chinatown, unlike Seattle's, for a long time, because there were never places to live. Mm-hmm. There were never apartments. I mean, Portland is strange in that way. I mean, there were not cheap places downtown, even for young people that aren't Asian, if they wanted to live there, could find. And so when they were given the opportunity to move, say, to Ladd's Addition or even to apartments on the east side where you could get a real bedroom, mm-hmm. you know, and not have to share a bath, that was appealing to people and had families, young families.
Mm-hmm.
But they continued to come. I mean, the reason people say this is the Chinatown is that this is the place where the CCBA is.
Yeah.
It's where the family associations and the Tongs are, where the restaurants people have known for a long time. That this is still the ceremonial community center, even though parking is tough. It looks like a skid row half the time. You know, it's one of these dilemmas. I don't know what's going to happen with the younger generation, but I wanted, because they're not connected to this in the same way that the elders are that we're working with, but I want Dean to talk a little bit about something that happened in Seattle that didn't happen here, that seems to have been a catalyst, you know, for that Chinatown hanging on longer. Dean, do you want to talk about what happened with the young people?
Well, back in the late 60s, early 70s, young Asian American activists decided that their community needed health care and low-income housing and all kinds of services. And they knocked on the door of the city and the county and said, you need to fund a health clinic. You need to fund a group that helps people find housing, all that sort of thing. So all that was came out of the Asian American movement.
We could use that.
Inspired by the civil rights movement. So this is young people trying to, you know, help their community. So we ended up building housing and a health clinic and a lot of services for the community.
Do you still see a lot of, I don't know how involved you are in the community associations in Seattle's Chinatown, but do you still feel like there are lots of young people energized to help improve their community?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much young people are joining those organizations.
That's part of the problem, I think.
But yeah, we need young blood to keep those organizations going.
Yeah, that definitely helps.
They're all getting older.
Yeah. Right.
Well, this is why we've, you know, it's really interesting because this group of elders, this is something they've wanted for decades, this museum.
Right.
And so this is the fulfillment of a dream for them. But when we started and we started unveiling this history and, you know, digging deeper and deeper, and they said, oh, we don't know anything about old Chinatown. And pretty soon, you know, here are some photographs and here are some documents, and we start making those connections, and suddenly there it is. And the links are much deeper, and we have documents nobody knew what they were. So it's just an amazingly exciting and rich moment in time for retrieving that history. And that's what the Beyond the Gate exhibit is about.
I see.
At the same time, I think what's happening now, I think we understand that, you know, and they do too, that finally, now that we've been successful or almost successful, they realize, you know, that they're of an age when they really can't expect this to be just for them.
Right.
You know, and so now it's got to be a museum for their children and grandchildren.
It has to be sustained.
And so one of the ways into that younger generation is the arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we've made the decision to become, and just like we are for the Yat Sing Music Club, that's for them, for the older generation. But we want to provide this venue, you know, because it's amazing to me. I have to say I'm very impressed by the talent in this community. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just an extraordinary number of very, very talented Asian American writers and painters and, you know, and musicians. I mean, and
podcasts and radio shows.
Yes, and radio shows. And yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so that energy is something that, you know, we really want to try to mobilize on behalf of, you know, these very serious questions about how do you sustain yourself? What does it mean to be Asian American? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how do you relate to these organizations where women still can't vote, you know, kind of thing? I mean, you know, I mean, I think these are really important questions. And what does Asian America have to offer the rest of the country? And I think it's a lot, you know, so...
I know I definitely resonate with the questions of how young people can get involved, because I know when I was growing up, I felt like when my parents went to bond with the Chinese community in Salem, that was for them, and it wasn't really for me. And I've always felt really distant from the Chinese community in Salem and Portland. I think part of it is just how white the state is. But I actually really would like to get involved. I mean, how can people get involved if they want to help out and help revitalize and preserve the Portland Chinatown?
I think there are lots of opportunities. I mean, I think one of the things that we're all exhausted right now. I mean, we are. I mean, we've done an amazing thing in the last few years. I mean, we went from persuading Louis Lee, you know, to allow us to, he gave us to rent this quarter block with an option to buy, you know, and he allowed us then to sort of raise the money that would have been for a down payment and turn it into a security deposit that we could then spend on renovations. But I want to tell you that even before Beyond the Gate, which is going to cost about another $100,000-$150,000 to finish, that we have raised and spent with this remodel, I mean, about $900,000.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this is an amazing thing that this Chinese community has been able to do. Now, we've been very fortunate. We have gotten support from PDC and from some of the big foundations, which is wonderful, of the Oregon Community of Foundation, the Oregon Cultural Trust, the Collins Foundation.
So for any folks in the community who...
Call us. Yes. I mean, Dr. Jennifer Fang, this is the other thing that's kind of unusual about us. I mean, we consider ourselves really a community-based organization, and that is a commitment. Mm-hmm. You know, that not only are we concerned with trying to sort of help to stabilize Chinatown itself and revitalize it in a more modern way that's going to engage young people, but we also want to retrieve that history before it's too late. I mean, this is a generation that is beginning to pass, and once they're gone, the photographs will never be identified. Families will throw things away. You know, so we're really working against the clock to try to, you know, to retrieve this history and to express it through these doors. But we already have, when you come down, you'll be surprised. We have a full-service museum ready, almost ready to go, and we desperately need talent and volunteers. So if you've got anybody out there who would like to come and help us and help and work with elders, too, to help record oral histories and help ferret out where the stories are and how to connect those stories. I mean, Dee Mae Roberts, for instance, is doing such wonderful things when you connect the stories of these generations. Mm-hmm. And this is what we want to do. I have to tell you that there's some elders that were so distressed when I said we were going to do Horatio Law's Two Ghettos in our space, and they saw these Japanese and as well as Chinese musicians, you know. And I said, well, this is Chinatown, and Chinatown always was a home for many peoples. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks later, when we opened, or 3 weeks later, here's Joe Kai, you know, who's Korean-American, and his music is very modern. And I heard an older person say from the CCBA, I thought this was a Chinese museum, history museum. And they left. But then the person who had complained about, was concerned about the Japanese musicians, she was rocking out with everybody else. I mean, she could see that there was something electric in the room that all of these younger people were really identifying with. And it was so wonderful to me to see, yes, they really do understand that now this is for them. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's also for a dialogue between them. So this is also an opportunity for younger Asian Americans, you know, to come and work with some of these elder groups, or just decide, we want to do a spoken word thing, we want to do poetry, how can we get involved as performers, as writers, as well? You know, I think we're wide open.
And so...
I don't want to leave Dean hanging on the line.
Right.
But
can we ask him one last question about if people missed his first event at the grand opening a few weeks ago, if you'll be back in town for, you know, any more events at the when they reopen after the renovations?
I'll be at the next first Thursday.
Awesome.
Okay. And Dean will probably come down for a special program, too. His show is up until September 2nd, and so we're going to be having programs regularly on Thursday nights, and he'll come down and do his own reading, and I would urge everybody to be present for that, because he's absolutely amazing.
And so that's first Thursday, work. July 5th?
Yeah.
And then
there'll be another one, which we haven't scheduled
another
yet.
Another one
probably
to
in
be
August.
Yeah. In August sometime. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Dean.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a good one. And so, thanks again to Jackie for joining us as well. Appreciate the history. And I have one last quick question before we let you go, because I heard, just to go back to the original revelation, that there was an earlier incarnation of Chinatown that, you know, was pretty wide. I heard there was a second Chinatown that was in Southwest Portland near Goose Hollow.
I think you're referring to this. This was actually, I mean, they were part of old Chinatown, and this was a community.
Oh, it just spread that far.
Well, no, that was particularly a farming community. I mean, that was a low place. It's where the Multnomah Athletic Club is now located. Mm-hmm. And it was part of the kind of, it's underground now. The city put Tanner Creek underground, so you don't even know that it's there any longer, but there used to be a river kind of almost bigger than a little stream, and it was bubbled up, and these were amazingly, you know, kind of, it was a damp area that was very fertile, and so farmers settled there, and they became the primary suppliers of fresh produce, not just for Chinatown, but for the whole city.
Oh,
they
wow.
also were the wood cutters. This is before you've got gas or electricity. So they're delivering firewood all winter, as well as growing vegetables. It was also, there's a couple of wonderful photographs of that community where if you look at the top of the photographs, you see the beginning of those mansions up in the West Hills. And many of these people who supplied, these are some of the things that you'll hear about in our exhibit.
I mean, so people can find photographs of that in the exhibit.
They can.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But they'll also learn that Chinese cuisine, you know, it became Chop Suey USA, right? Chinese food is the first fast food in America.
Yeah.
Also. But in the 1890s, it was the haute cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So those houses had Chinese Chinese cooks.
Oh, okay. You
know. Well, what are the hours, after the renovations are completed, what will be the regular hours for the museum?
Okay, until Beyond the Gate is installed. Now, this is a 3,500 square foot multimedia show that's called it's called Beyond the Gate, A Tale of Portland's Historic Chinatowns, Old and New. And it's gorgeous. It's recreations of lottery, restaurants, dry goods stores, workers' vignette. It's the director is Kerry Wong from our community, who is a well-known theater and opera set designer.
Okay.
So it's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Anyway, up until then, which will be in October, we hope, our hours will be Thursday afternoon and evening from 3 to 8, Friday, Saturday, Sunday afternoons.
Okay.
Awesome.
Well,
thank you very much.
And if you're interested, please reach out to the museum for volunteering.
Also go to our website, www.portlandchinatown.org.
All right. Thanks so much, Jackie. Thanks, Tabitha.
Thank you, Jake. Have a good day.
Thank you. Sorry.
It is 12 o'clock of the noon, or 12 noon of the clock, at KBOO Portland, your community radio, where, with the generous support of you and your friends and neighbors, it is possible to bring you a wide variety. Stuff you love, stuff about which you're indifferent, stuff you hate. But it's not just about you, is it? No, it's about the community. And that's why some of you have tuned in right now to hear the one, the only, the inimitable, and all-around mensch, Don Jacobson, bringing you 90 minutes of the very best of folk roots Americana anywhere in this or any other universe. So stay tuned. That's coming up right after the news and these important community announcements.
It's time for the news at noon for Friday, June 22nd, 2018. Today, the Supreme Court voted